conducted the London Philharmonic for the lovely Lucia Pop. And that's all for another Sunday. Thanks for your company today. Rob's back next week, Easter Day, and we'll be serving up a typically nutritious menu, including the final Bach cantata in our year-long series of church cantatas, plus music by Gershwin, Elgar and Steve Reich.
Sunday Morning with James Jolly is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
Belief with Joan Bakewell.
Do you pray? Do you talk to your God? Is your role as a storyteller a highly moral one?
Well, you came to power in the White House as a religious man. What hopes did you have for your time there, and which of them do you believe were realised?
A daily series in which artists, scientists and thinkers talk candidly about what they believe and why.
You are on a journey to improve yourself along moral standards, aren't you?
I would like to improve myself, I would like to improve the world.
The new series begins with a man some have called the Poet Laureate of Medicine, the author and neurologist Oliver Sacks.
For myself, I can only believe in a world of here and now, and I can hardly imagine any other.
Belief on BBC Radio 3. The new series starts Easter Monday at 10:30.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time now for Private Passions with Michael Barclay. And in the week that new Archbishop has been enthroned at Canterbury, here's another chance to hear a programme recorded in 2008 with the outgoing Archbishop, now Master of Magdalene College, Cambridge.
My guest today is a man of letters, a noted poet, and he's also the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, and in fact we're sitting in Lambeth Palace. You have spoken, Dr. Williams, of the appalled compassion of Shakespeare. I thought it was a rather wonderful term. And I wonder whether you find in music that appalled compassion. One thinks, for example, of the metaphysical poets Donne and Herbert, and how the nature of belief collides very happily with those poets and their verse. And I wonder whether you find a similar kind of analogy with music.
I think that a lot of the pieces that I've selected today are there precisely because they convey to me something of that same characteristic. It's the freedom to look, to feel without protection, and still to sense that there is something sayable on the far side of it. And to me, that's very much what comes out in Bach's Passions, in Dowland, in others of the people I've chosen today. So yes, it's the musical correlate of exactly that in Shakespeare or in Donne.
And do you find that in the sort of everyday use of music in worship, that it's something which is functional or something that is transporting at its best?
At its best, I think it's transporting. I think if it's just trying to fill in the silence, then it's failing. And while sometimes it can rightly be just a kind of expression of solidarity, I think it's doing its job most effectively when it's more than that, when it's actually pushing you a bit out of the boundaries.
You mentioned Bach just now and the St. Matthew Passion, which we're going to begin with. It does seem to me that this music gets to the very heart, if not the very soul, of who we are and why we exist.
It's music you can't simply listen to as a, well, you can't say a spectator exactly, but just as an audience. As it was originally performed, of course, the congregation would have been drawn in at various points, but also at moment after moment in the narrative, it's as if the whole focus swivels round onto the individual, and you're asked, well, where am I? Where are my emotions here? So the arias express the particular person drawn up in the story suddenly becoming Mary, Judas, Peter, or whatever. And you can't have it at arm's length. I think that's exactly why it goes so deep.
When you hear something as sublime as this, do you feel, in a way, that somebody's been touched by something spiritual, that, or something that we cannot understand? I mean, that somebody like Mozart or Shakespeare, or in this case Bach, has almost some kind of divine connection.
It's very tempting to feel that, isn't it? I tell myself when tempted that to remember that Bach was a harassed, overworked, extremely prosaic character, who doubtless scribbled a great deal of the Matthew Passion because he had a deadline to meet. And I tell myself, genius and even inspiration work at that level too. You mustn't just think of the solitary figure turning his eyes skyward with a pen in his mouth. But that being said, when I listen to them, I think this is about as far as expression can go. We're on the frontiers here, and they're looking further than I can. I can only try and look in the direction they're looking in, because something's been, I would have to say, as a Christian, something's given there, something's opened up.
And when we get to the end, which is what you've chosen, the final chorus, it is as though that music is a kind of summation of arrival, full of both despair and hope somehow.
That's right. It's sometimes people say, oh, well, you know, where's the resurrection in this? Well, hang about. It's not meant to come yet. First of all, draw together where you've been. Take a deep breath, rest, sit. It's been a long journey. And I found myself a couple of years ago trying to write a sequence of poems about the Matthew Passion as a sort of sea voyage, and imposed on that also a long and wakeful night, and trying to bring those together, because it seems to me that the images that the final chorus evokes for me are those of somehow finally being able to sleep after a sleepless night and finally coming back after a long voyage.
Well, let's hear that music, and then perhaps you'd be kind enough to read the verse that it inspired.
back to the headland fogs, exhausted with new grief, old treacheries, the view without prospect. Rain falling in a slow afternoon, between light and dark, no questions any more. The long grey leaving of the day that never reaches night, the turning water that will never carry us to the pole of sleep. White nights. Wir setzen uns in some unwelcoming chair to wait. Scored down the sky, the neighing of a car alarm, night's horses running sluggishly. And then the unquiet of the muffled room as it bobs on a frustrated tide that never breathes out, never jolts into the wooden warmth of dock. Wood pulsing unevenly with a tired surge as the fire fades. 5 o'clock cloud and damp clogging the throat. Slowly the line is drawn again, tight between sea and sky, though not where we remember, settled after the night's fast-running sweats. With the dawn, sleep soft.
Thank you. Wir setzen uns by Rowan Williams, and before that we heard the final chorus of the St. Matthew Passion by Bach with the Monteverdi Choir, the English Baroque soloists, directed by John Elliott Gardner. It's curious, isn't it, how great music and great verse humbles us, that we feel almost bowed down by in front of it. And I got that impression from reading that poem, that that conveyance of grief is partially what inspired you.
That's right, and the depth, the greatness of the music is, I suppose, an invitation to go out of your depth. And that's what makes you bow down. Someone has been there in a territory that you can't contain.
Interesting, too, that we're going to put together the sacred and, well, not the profane, but the secular with Bach now, because we're going to hear an instrumental work.
That's right, which, while it's a very different kind of work from the Matthew Passion, as different as could be, than a double concerto, nonetheless has some of the same features of a poignancy that breaks through into something else. And one of the things that I like about Bach's instrumental music, above all in the cello suites, is the way in which sort of ache and poignancy are still declared in a way that's almost triumphant. And this very beautiful sort of pastoral piece is
fascinating, accessible. How certain things that he does sort of go straight to your heart. We both looked at each other at that concluding cadence in the St. Matthew Passion, where
that's
he
right.
has a suspension.
It's
the
suspension,
two notes rub
yes,
against
yes,
each other.
Yes, that's right. And there's something there which says everything about the tension, the irresolution, that still miraculously, however long you hang on to it, finds a home, gets there.
Thank you. Music from Bach's Concerto in D minor for oboe and violin, BWV 1060. We heard Leon Goossens playing the oboe, Yehudi Menuhin the violin, with the Bath Festival Orchestra. Listening to that, I couldn't help thinking that what music there teaches us to a certain extent, if we care to listen to it, is the thing of listening to each other and answering. That's a question and answer, and inflecting our answer from what we've heard.
I think that's one of the things that's always fascinated me about the music of the Renaissance and the Baroque, that there's so much of discernible voices responding to one another. We hear it in some of the later things, in The Dowland and the Bird. And it's one of the things which, you know, in the days when I used to do a lot of singing, attracted me most about singing music from that period. It was something of a dialogue, something of a conversation, always responding to moderated, modulated by what had just been heard. And I think because, to me, conversation is a hugely important category in thinking about theology and philosophy, I quite like to hear it in music too.
I think also that ability, you mentioned singing, to actually make music together when people are young, for example, in a choir. I mean, singing in schools, it seems to me so important because it teaches you to listen to other people, to join in with them, to be in harmony, if you like, rather than in dissonance.
That's right. It was one of the things I found really fascinating about the television series on choirs recently and the building of a choir. How do you build a choir? And the fact that it's not just about acquiring a set of singing skills, it's acquiring a whole mindset, a confidence and also a receptivity going together.
I get the impression that quite apart from your calling in terms of the church, that there's a part of you that's very happy with poetry and words and academia in a sense. And that has led you to be very fond of certain people in particular, certain poets, isn't it?
That's right, yes. The inner life is fed very extensively by the poets I really like, including, I suppose, Auden, very definitely, and somebody like Geoffrey Hill more recently. I think simply as a critic and a reader, you read his critical essays recently published, you realise that this is a very unusual mind indeed. And then you turn to the poetry and you have both the amazing lyricism and musicality of some of what he says and then the very deliberate, very shocking, in some ways, reversal of that in some of his recent work where he's almost pushing the envelope of colloquial and raw speech to say the critical things, the unconsoled things. It's a rare variety of registers and of gifts.
We've got a happy marriage here because I think you wanted some John Dowland, and he has written a poem inspired by Dowland, I think.
Yes, he wrote a sequence of poems inspired by Dowland's Lacrimae, the Seven Tears.
So perhaps you would just be kind enough to tell us which Dowland you'd like to hear, and then we can preface it with the appropriate poem.
Dowland's variations on the Lacrimae, Pavan, Seven Tears, figured in Seven Passionate Pavans. That's the title of Geoffrey Hill's sequence, and I'd like to read Pavana Dolorosa. Loves I allow and passions I approve. Ash Wednesday feasts, ascetic opulence, the wincing lute so real in its pretense, itself a passion amorous of love. Self-wounding martyrdom, what joys you have, true torn among this fictive consonance. Music's creation of the moveless dance, the decreation to which all must move. Self-seeking hunter of forms, there is no end to such pursuits. None can revoke your cry. Your silence is an ecstasy of sound, and your nocturnals blaze upon the day. I founder in desire for things unfound. I stay amid the things that will not stay. Thank you.
Nigel North was playing the Lacrimae Pavan by John Dowland on the lute. It's been a hallmark of this programme, Dr. Williams, we've done over 600 now, that people are inexorably drawn more to sad, slightly tragic music. I mean, of course, there is uplifting music, and they love that too, and it's, there is that in the Matthew Passion, but there is a sort of preponderance for music which disturbs us. Why do you think that is?
I wonder if the word is disturbs. It's more, I think, for me, resonating with what, for I guess the majority of human beings, is the place they live a lot of the time. That is an awareness of the brokenness of things, the vulnerability of selves. So that massively triumphant and affirmative music is a wonderful episode, and yet getting through the long bits in between where you recognise the both the darkness and the shabbiness, you need the vehicles to carry you through that. With, again, using one of Geoffrey Hill's terms, a sad and angry consolation. Mm. And that's perhaps what the darker music carries for us.
When you hear great music in, say, a great cathedral, that seems to me to be an extraordinary help, if you like. I mean, and what we need all the help we can get, after all, to achieving something spiritual. So I find that very hard sometimes to equate with things that are very moving in another sense. One's thinking of some of the evangelical singing, for example, mm-hmm. which has its own power. But do you find yourself confused by this? Because you must be exposed to all sorts.
Absolutely. One of the things that bishops have to get used to is that, you know, 99 times out of 100, you will be taking part in a service whose structure you haven't chosen, and you have to learn styles and languages very differently. And I think you simply have to immerse in that. You have to say, well, what is good? What is life-giving here? And
so it's like everything, really. If it's good, then that's fine.
If it's good, it's good, yes. Yeah. And there's traditional church music that's sentimental and untruthful, just as there's modern music that's sentimental and untruthful.
And it certainly is true, isn't it, that if you hear, for example, a wonderful gospel choir in full swing, that's pretty powerful stuff.
I was taking part in the memorial service for Stephen Lawrence's murder, the 50th anniversary of Stephen Lawrence's murder, and to hear young black children from an inner London school singing gospel songs with a professional singer was just as moving as any of this.
Well, it's not that exactly we're going to hear, but perhaps the equivalent of its day, which is music by William Byrd.
Byrd, I think, intriguing because he's someone who, as a Catholic writing for the Church of England, is always writing a little bit at a distance from involvement, and writing quite often is Catholic music for very small private consumption. Something of that privacy, that hiddenness, the low-key quality, carries over even into his music for the Anglican Church and gives it an austerity and a stillness, which, even when he's being most triumphant and affirmative, as in this Christ Rising piece, comes through.
So feeling of being at the still centre of the turning
still
world.
Centre, yes, exactly.
Thank you.
Christ Rising Again from the Dead by William Byrd. Yeachin Park and Ben Williamson were the trebles with the choir of Westminster Abbey. Robert Quinney was the organist, directed by James O'Donnell. And interestingly, you were saying about Byrd having been a Catholic. And of course, James O'Donnell was actually at Westminster Cathedral before going to the Abbey.
Abbey, yes.
And so there have been several choir masters who have swapped around. Even, I mean, Stephen Clebrick King's came from the Cathedral. So that rather forward Mediterranean sound that George Malcolm and Terry fostered at Westminster Cathedral has begun to sort of find its way into the slightly more cooing sound of the Anglican cathedrals.
It's been a very interesting development in my own lifetime, I think. I remember when I was a teenager having two recordings of Britain's Missa Brevis, one by the cathedral, one by St. John's, Cambridge, and realising Britain was actually writing from one kind of voice, not the other.
Yes.
But now I don't think if you listen to Christchurch, Oxford singing the Britain Missa Brevis, you wouldn't really be able to tell that much difference from the Westminster Cathedral version.
It's rather nice. It's almost like the coming together of the churches that you'd like to see anyway, I think.
Absolutely. And music is an ecumenical boundary breaker, and perhaps always has been. Byrd is a case in point. The fact that he almost miraculously managed to maintain his integrity as a Catholic while working with great effect and no pressure within the Anglican system.
And in a wider context, it would be nice if we could embrace the cultures of other religions and other... Because often it is through the culture that one can find a way to connect.
That's right. And when you begin to understand what the sounds are that reverberate within the skulls of other people, whether it's another individual or a whole culture, then you begin to understand them. You begin to understand the drum they march to, as you might say.
We mentioned Shakespeare at the beginning, Dr. Williams, and... we are going to the composer who I suppose is most closely thought of as being Shakespearean in his ability to embrace human emotion.
Yes, and I think turning to the magic flute, there's a Shakespearean quality to the plot. That is, it's in some ways a perfectly dreadful plot. It doesn't make any sense at all, and you just take it as it comes with every absurdity of the turns of the plot as they develop. You take it as it comes, and you realise that somewhere underneath it is a rhythm and a movement that's very different. And the end of Act One, the appearance of the three boys, that does have a very, very special quality to it. I think it's a moment which is, if you like, neither sad nor joyful, but just a statement, a very, very simple harmonic sequence. And Mozart's ability not only to amaze you with wonderful, fluid melody, but also sometimes to do the most astonishingly simple things, plain sequences of chords, that always delights me in him.
The opening of the finale of Act One of The Magic Flute by Mozart. Uwe Heilmann was Tamino, and the three boys were Markus Leitner, Michael Rausch and Max Emanuel Chenchik, with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by George Scholte. Well, now we come, Rowan Williams, to a more recent composer, Benjamin Britten, and of course we mentioned him with the Missa Brevis. Mm.
Yes, I discovered Britten as a teenager and found that he had so many of the qualities that I was valuing in earlier music and was doing very new things with them. And my recollection of this particular piece when I first heard it was actually the broadcast of the very first performance of The Burning Fiery Furnace in the 60s. And it was being broadcast live from the Aldborough Festival. I sat in my bedroom trying desperately with a very cheap transistor radio to tune in to the third program to get it. So it was a slightly indistinct impression, but it was one that, as you see, has lasted. To see Britten's management there of, rather as in the Mozart, something about stating the sheer there-ness of the transcendent in the middle, the soaring voice that sails over the top of the others, the way in which, quite often in his work, he can manage to convey that, what I've called the sheer there-ness of the other, the strange, which sometimes in his work is very menacing, as well as very enlarging and enriching. Mm.
O All Ye Works of the Lord, from The Burning Fiery Furnace by Benjamin Britten, and we heard John Shelley Quirk, Robert Teer, Stafford Dean, and the English Opera Group, directed by the composer.
And one thing that I find so moving about that Burning Fiery Furnace extract is that it's as if Britten is trying to put into music something which, as a theologian, I would say is very fundamental. It's the notion of the Incarnation, Christ coming into the world, both echoing and transfiguring what's being said and sung in all the different voices going on underneath. And for someone who was a somewhat patchy religious believer, as Britton was, I think he's done something extraordinary from the
I was going to ask you, actually, as an artist yourself, whether you feel there is ever a conflict between... Because the nature of being an artist is to be extremely questioning in one sense. And the nature of belief is to a degree being not unquestioning, but to be accepting.
I think this is why an artist like, George Herbert in the 17th century, or Geoffrey Hill in the 20th, or for that matter, a Briton in his own way, seems to me important for understanding what faith is and faith isn't. That it's not mechanical, unquestioning obedience to something. It's almost thinking, well, here is a structure of belief and vision which gives me so much freedom. I can test the boundaries as much as I like, and somehow something is going to hold me up. But I can take immense risks with it. And I think the Christian artist would probably want to say something like that. I'm not quite sure where this is going. Things are dissolving. The words aren't holding up. And yet, I can push the boundaries because there is, as in the Fiery Furnace piece, there is another voice.
Now, I think we're going to hear something which you would characterise as a rather sentimental choice.
Well, almost entirely, because it was a piece that I heard a lot as a teenager, that my family enjoyed. And some of what we live with and value in music is, of course, not just a sort of a judgment of how good it is, or even sometimes how deeply it speaks to the most important things in you, but about a background which feeds in its own way, which just gives a steady, warming colour to your emotional life. And I think this was one of the pieces which, when I was a teenager, worked like that for me.
Thank you.
Music from the Piano Concerto in A Minor, Opus 54 by Schumann. We heard Mura Limpany playing with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by the irrepressible Thomas Beecham. Just listening to that just now, we were both sort of excited by the rhythm. And it reminds one how much music goes back to dance and dance form, doesn't it?
That's right. And I think, as with poetry, one forgets at one's peril the absolute physicality of music. It is meant to involve the whole of you. It's about the fundamental physical fact that we are creatures built on stress and slack. Systole and diastole. The thing tenses and releases all the time. And that's about the whole of our bodiliness, and that's not surprising. And I suppose that's why people have thought music is a kind of cosmic clue, and all the imagery about the music of the spheres does, I was going to say, ring a bell with us, and of course, just to use that metaphor tells us how deeply it's ingrained.
Yes. Well, this last music certainly rings a particular bell for you, isn't it? And it's, again, partially sentimental, but also very
beautiful. I couldn't entirely let this opportunity go, I think, without putting in the Welsh music that, for the whole of my life, has been part of that internal set of sounds reverberating in the skull. And this is, in fact, a piece coming from Southeast Wales, from the area where I worked as a bishop for a very long time. It's a piece that I learned as a schoolboy. It's a well-known, rather simple folk song about sending the bird as messenger to the loved one, saying, "I'm waiting for a letter."
The Pure Bird. Hugh Rhys-Evans was singing that Welsh folk song, with Ewan Jones playing the harp. Are you able to find time to continue to write your poetry, Dr. Williams?
It's not so much a question of being able to find time. When poems need writing, they need writing. You have to make time somehow. But I do find it helps travelling quite a bit, that there's a little bit of open time to let them simmer, let them come to the boil sometimes.
I'm rather pleased to hear. So, I mean, sometimes it just simply has to come out and you have to write something
out somewhere, yes. You don't really have very much choice about it. And if you don't get it out and begin working, then it'll go away. Auden somewhere talks about the two different kinds of poems, the one that arrives and you say, actually not yet, and the one that arrives and you say, sorry, too late. And it's getting the moment when you've got to get it down. So, yes, finding time, time finds you for it, I think.
Dr. Rowan Williams, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, was talking to Michael Barclay, and that programme was first broadcast in June 2008. Well, next Sunday at midday, Michael's guest will be the actress Janet Sussman. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's edition was Chris Marshall. Well, this is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM. We're also on digital radio and also online. It's 1 o'clock and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. David Cameron is to use a speech tomorrow to harden his stance on immigration, promising that migrants won't be considered for social housing in England until they've spent at least 2 years in the country. Local authorities will have to introduce minimum residency times of between 2 and 5 years for joining waiting lists. The President of Cyprus is in Brussels to try to finalise an international bailout plan intended to save his country from going bankrupt. A spokesman for the Cypriot government said he had a very difficult task ahead of him. Nikos Anastasiadis will have to explain how he'll raise 5.8 billion euros by tomorrow. After meeting EU officials, he'll hold talks with the heads of the International Monetary Fund and European Central Bank. Police investigating the death of the Russian tycoon Boris Berezovsky have given his home the all-clear following tests for nuclear, chemical and biological substances. His body was found at the mansion in Berkshire yesterday. The cause of his death is not known, but friends have said he was feeling depressed. Severe weather's continuing to cause disruption across the UK, with thousands of homes still without power in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. One of the worst affected areas is the Isle of Arran, which has been without mains electricity since Friday morning. The M1 is closed in both directions near Coventry. East Midlands Airport was closed all morning but has just reopened. Pope Francis has celebrated his first Palm Sunday Mass in St Peter's Square. During the service, he announced that he would travel to Brazil to attend a Catholic youth festival in Rio de Janeiro in July. Sebastian Vettel of Red Bull has won the Malaysian Grand Prix. His teammate Mark Webber came second and Lewis Hamilton took third place for Mercedes. And let's look at the weather again. There'll be more snow, mainly across Northern Ireland, Wales and parts of Western and Central England. The snow will gradually ease, although there'll be some showers in northeast England. It'll continue to be bitterly cold and windy. Tonight will be largely dry, with patchy snow and a hard frost. BBC News and weather at 1:02. And now time for the early music show. And today, Lucy Skeeping looks at the splendour of Baroque architecture and stage design.
If you follow the Vltava River south from Prague towards its headquarters not far from the Czech border with Austria, you reach Český Krumlov in southern Bohemia. Český is the site of one of Europe's great medieval castles, and it looms forbiddingly over the narrowing river. It's not one of those great stone crenellated fortifications, though, like Prague Castle or, say, Dublin Castle. Český is more like a city, 30 or 40 buildings and a series of courtyards put up over several centuries, and they're all decorated with the most amazing trompe d'oeil.
¶¶
And in the fifth courtyard stands what's perhaps the jewel of the entire complex and what we've come to see today, Chesky Krumlov's amazing Baroque theatre. Like so much else in this part of the world, it's a product of Habsburg times, of the German-speaking princes who, for three centuries up until the First World War, in fact, ruled what we now think of as the Czech Republic. The first theatre was built in the 1680s by Prince Johann Christian von Eggenberg. His domains extended down into the Veneto, and we find him making a number of visits to Venice, in particular frequenting the relatively new entertainment of opera that was flourishing there. Evidently made a deep impression, and so back home here at Chesky Castle, he employed Italian architects to oversee the building work of his own theatre, and there was soon a highly competent company of actors and musicians in residence, and a library stocked with the best literature and drama from throughout Europe. But it wasn't until nearly a century later, in the 1770s and 80s, that the theatre really achieved its true glory. Prince Joseph Adam von Schwarzenberg now had the entire place renovated, or reconstructed, you could say, and for 20 years, the theatre, complete with sophisticated systems of ropes and pulleys and movable footlights, the very latest scene-changing technology, resonated to the sights and sounds of Italian opera seria and opera buffa, French opera and opera comique, and German singspiel, as well as a potpourri of danced and dramatised variations on the ancient myths. Well, there's going to be a lot to see, and so I've brought along with me the theatre historian Ian McIntosh, who's promised to take us into some of the backstage areas that are usually out of bounds. Well, it's pretty cold up here. There's snow on the ground below, and although I've got my thermals on, I think we ought to go inside to follow in the footsteps of the princes, the wealthy merchants, and the townspeople who flocked here for opera performances. Mind you, it wasn't just a musical experience for them. It was a visual feast as well, which began just as soon as they stepped into the salon. Thank you. Well, Ian, we're in the most amazing room. It's painted. We've got five glorious chandeliers. What would have happened in here?
This is where the prince would welcome his guests. He would have come from the far end of the castle. There are three floors in the castle, all richly decorated. But this one is unique. It's 1766, and it's decorated totally in flat painting. When you go into a Baroque room like this of the late 18th century, in most castles in Europe, there's plaster work. It's full of mouldings. This is actually all flat painting. And the flat painting is very musical. There are collections of musical instruments. I mean, any historian can see exactly